This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics. I'm Seth Tevill. If you've been anywhere near the internet in the last few weeks, you'll have seen speculation reach fever pitch over Kategate. It's not just the unexplained disappearance from public view of a senior royal, it's the frankly bizarre release of a crudely photoshopped image of the princess, which has prompted all manner of rumour, innuendo, conspiracy theory, and just plain curiosity. This is nothing new. Photographs that are fake, or at the very least enhanced, have been with us for almost as long as photos have existed. Yet the easy availability of Photoshop technology and the increasing sophistication of deepfakes has prompted fears that this is going to become a feature of our daily lives. Already, the US presidential election has seen the use of an AI-generated Joe Biden telephoning voters with incriminating messages. Here to make sense of it all is Dr. Joshua Habgood-Coote, an expert in social epistemology and philosophy at the University of Leeds. He's also the co-author of the second shortest paper in philosophy, Can a Good Philosophical Contribution Be Made by Just Asking a Question? The abstract for this published article reads, "This article has no associated abstract." Welcome to The Bunker, Josh.
Hiya, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. The internet's been abuzz with people trying to deconstruct Kate Middleton's photoshopped picture. Have we seen anything like this before?
Yeah, so the answer is yes, and surprisingly much. So there's like a short-term history and a much longer-term history here. So what it looks like happened with this photograph is that a number of different exposures of the same scene have been stitched together to kind of get the best bits of all of the different members of the family. Now, that's a pretty common Photoshop technique. So that's been used by people who've been using Photoshop for, 30 years at this point or something like that. But the basics of that technique, and in fact, lots of techniques that are used by Photoshop, go back to really the beginnings of photography. So there's really famous images from the 19th century. Kind of saliently here, one from photographer Henry Peach Robinson called Fading Away, of a woman who's kind of in the course of dying with her family standing around pensively in front of a window, which is a fake. Like, these different people have been taken from different exposures and stitched together. So yeah, this technique has been going on really from the beginning of photography. And one of the things that you realize if you start to look at the kind of history of manipulated images is that there's really quite a complicated history here. It's not just photography has always been reliable and now it's suddenly started to become less reliable with Photoshops and deepfakes. There's all these different kinds of like funky techniques that people have been using really since the beginning of the technology.
Is there something to be said about trust? Because if we look at something very different, which is pictures, as in drawings, you know, cave paintings going back at least tens of thousands of years, you imagine that there's going to be a certain element of reinterpretation, shall we say. But is there something about the sort of trust that we've tended to place on photos as something different?
Yeah, so there's kind of two differences, I guess. So one is you might think like drawings have like a greater latitude of interpretation. You could, a viewer can like see more things in an image. But actually that's true of photography as well. If you just get presented with a photograph, an image, you don't have any contextual information for where it was taken, for what people are doing. You've just got a kind of snapshot in time. But a really important difference that lots of theorists who've thought about photography, going back to Walter Benjamin, but also philosophers have really focused on, is the fact that when you have a drawing, there's a person who's made choices about what to represent. Whereas in the case of a photograph, supposedly, there's no choices being made about what to represent or how to represent a scene. The only connection between reality and the viewer at the end of the kind of line is this purely mechanical process. So photographs are like distinctive because you don't have to rely on anyone to rely on the image. Just the mere presence of faked photographs kind of changes the kind of reliance involved in photographs from something where you're just relying on a mechanical process to something where you have to rely on people here as well. So like the philosopher Regina Rinne has really nicely articulated this idea that there's some threat of faked photographs and videos that changes the way we rely on them and then makes them less valuable for everyone.
And of course, even at the most basic level, without even getting into fakery or manipulation, you speak to any photographer and they will tell you that there are choices behind the angle used, behind what's shown, behind everything about, you know, the shutter that's used, the lighting that's used.
Yeah, 100%. There's an idea, it's like nature's pencil is drawing on the photographic negative. Just struggles to deal with photographic practice. And then there's this like difficult historical point where actually if you look through the history, for long periods in the 19th century and a bit of the early 20th century, huge swathes of images were manipulated because the technology just wasn't good enough, right? It wasn't possible to take really crisp and nice images. But there's all of these practices of touching up and painting over photographs. And for lots of the 19th century, this is like really, really common, perhaps even like a majority of images were manipulated in some way.
Just for context for our listeners, I mean, the first photograph is sort of generally accepted. There are competing claims to this, but it's sort of dated to about 1825. It's quite a crude image and quite faded. Photography becomes a lot more common relatively from about the 1840s onwards. But you're saying that really since about then, it's already been manipulated as long as it's existed.
The first like really definite image that's been doctored is an image from the 1840s. It's an image of some Capuchin monks. And the photographer who took it decided that he didn't like the way that they were composed. There were like too many of them. So he went into the negative and painted out one of the monks. So it was against the sky. So you see three monks in the eventual image, but we've got the negative and the image next to each other. So you can see the change being made. It was like really, really common in portrait practice, in like different kinds of artistic practice. There were whole artistic practices associated with like different ways you could use double exposures or deliberate blur. But also within journalism, it was really common, particularly in the United States, to fake photographs and to change them to make them more colourful, to like correct problems with the way the photograph had been taken.
Can we talk maybe about some of the underlying motives for this? I mean, I assume for the journalism, we're really talking just about it's as simple as you want to sell more papers. There's no great conspiracy on that. It's just to make the events as dramatic or interesting as possible to the reader.
There's an interesting history here of going through different facets of journalism. The media scholar and historian Andy Tucher has some really nice historical work on this, where she argues that faking got phased out progressively through different aspects of journalism. So for a while in the 19th century, journalists, when they were writing, would defend faking and changing details to make a story more colourful or more attractive to a reader. And similarly, they would do the same. This was before you could directly print a photograph in a newspaper. So the etching that was a copy of a photograph would have changes in it to make it more attractive or more like eye-catching. And then when photographs were able to be printed in newspapers, the workers at newspapers, the journalists, would keep on doing that practice. They kept on changing details of photographs and they defended it. They said, everyone fakes. It's like a really important part of selling newspapers. So one thing that happened to stop that was not a change in technology or a change in the way photographs were taken, but just like a social norm against doing that kind of manipulation. And the word faking changing from a kind of neutral description of a technique that journalists would use into a term of criticism. So if you were accused of faking, you'd done something wrong. So really, there's a change of social norms that happens in US journalism around the kind of late 19th century into the early 20th century, which creates the conditions for photojournalism to become a reliable and reputable profession.
Let's look maybe at some of the more, shall we say, insidious or mischievous uses of photographs. I mean, the absolute master, as far as I can see on this in history, and it's not that he would personally do that, he's commissioned it, but it's Stalin. You know, Stalin, there are these extraordinary examples, not only of him inserting himself into photographs. You know, when Lenin was on his deathbed, he sort of puts himself at his side as being his best friend almost. But he also very famously would purge officials, and so he'd take them out of photographs, so there's an empty space next to Stalin, that sort of thing. But there's been quite a lot of that over the years, hasn't there?
Yeah, so around World War II, you see loads of satirical images that are kind of like putting together different political figures into basically what are like cartoons that are representing like satirical images of one figure being in the hand of another or like being controlled by someone else. And yeah, there are lots of different political uses of manipulated photographs to show images that are useful to different kinds of political figures. But I think One thing that's tricky is to understand these images like in their proper historical context. So part of the point of those images isn't to convince, but to demonstrate the like political power of the figures who are making the changes, right?
A warning, this could happen to you.
Yeah, it could happen to you. Look, I'm so powerful that I can like change the way that things are represented. So I think we shouldn't be thinking that the bad effects of manipulated photographs are just in convincing the viewers that like something is true that isn't. I think we shouldn't be thinking in general that people are like just credulous and believed whatever was in the images. And lots of these uses of manipulated photographs are really just satirical and jokes. There's like massive series of postcards where manipulated photographs have been put together so that there are like headless figures and figures inside trees and stuff. Those images aren't meant to convince people, right? They're just satirical images. And that kind of context is important for thinking about faked images now.
But there are also certainly cases that are intended to convince. I mean, there's a very famous fake photograph, for example, of John Kerry from around the time he was running for president, but it's of a young John Kerry in the 1960s speaking at a rally with Jane Fonda. And she was sort of seen as this very radical figure in the 60s. Well, Jane Fonda had spoken at lots of demos and John Kerry had spoken at lots of demos, but they'd never been side by side. And, you know, it's questionable whether that is, as you say, just to sort of give a flavour or whether it allows or sort of empowers people to say, you know, we've caught you red-handed. You were actually sharing a platform with her.
Yeah, 100%. And it is a concern that people might be misled by photographs that are manipulated. I think part of the point of stressing the diversity in the history of manipulated images is to push back against like what I take to be quite a dominant discourse around deepfakes, where it's a new scary threat that's going to undermine trust in all images. Insofar as there have been like this real problem about people being misled, there have been solutions from the past, right? So one of the things I want to get out of the story about US journalism at the turn of the 20th century is that there was a really effective solution to widespread, manipulated and inaccurate images, and it was to establish a social norm against spreading those images around. So it's kind of puzzling that when we're talking about deepfakes at the moment and faked images, there's so much focus on technological solutions like watermarks for deepfakes or automated detection, where we have a really effective solution available, which is like social norms within journalism. And one of the things we've seen in the pictures of Catherine Mountbatten Windsor is we've seen journalists and different sources of these images pulling them back once they realize they're fakes. And that seems like things are working well. Like we're acknowledging that these images exist and that we have techniques for not spreading them around. And if they do get out, making it clear that they are inaccurate images.
How much does this say about human psychology almost than our sort of willing to believe in these things? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of fake photographs of the paranormal, for instance. You know, there are a couple of examples from the 1920s, you know, a century old. One I can think of is those pictures of fairies, which had actually taken in people like Arthur Conan Doyle. He was convinced that this was positive proof that fairies existed. But also here you have things like that very famous photograph of the Loch Ness Monster, which, you know, had people fooled for about 60 or 70 years until eventually the guy who took it on his deathbed admitted it was a toy submarine. You know, how much does that say something about us wanting to believe that?
Push back on a particular reading of these kinds of faked photographs where there's an inaccurate image that gets out and the problem is that each individual is like too credulous, or we're just like set up innately to believe whatever image we see. I think what goes wrong in each of these cases is something about the way our institutions are set up to deal with and disseminate images. So in a way, the problem with the fairy photographs, which are quite realistic, you might get convinced by them if you think it's an open question whether fairies exist. One thing that goes wrong in the way that we establish trust and deal with trust in that case is that Conan Doyle gets pulled in by them, and he's got quite a lot of like reputation and quite a lot of credibility in that context. So him putting his credibility behind the images creates a situation where they're much more likely to get believed by many more people. So there's a problem about perhaps too much trust being placed in someone who's not trustworthy in their ability to tell apart reliable from unreliable images. So I think in a way it's more helpful to think not about individual successes or failings and how individuals should deal with images, given that they might be accurate or inaccurate, but in terms of what institutions we should be establishing and how those institutions should be run, putting things out on social media where like the most surprising image gets the most traction and gets disseminated the most, has like some worse features because there's like an incentive to share surprising images of things which aren't in fact true. Like there was recently some, well, probably like a year ago now, all these funky images produced through machine learning systems of creatures in surprising colors that went super, super viral because people were really surprised that there was like a bird who was a very striking color of blue or something like that. The fact that social media networks like spread those images so much without any kind of barrier or checking seems like a problem with the institution. It's not like necessarily just a problem with individuals who might believe or not believe that the images are accurate.
Are we responding to them differently because of their scale? I mean, I think we were quite used to the idea that you might find the possibility of the odd fake photograph, but by and large, you tended not to question its reality. Whereas now we're so used to everyone having Photoshop, every image possibly having been at least slightly massaged in some way.
It's really tricky to know historically, because some of the reading of the historical record that I want to suggest we should take seriously as a possibility is that actually, like, fake photographs and manipulated photographs were much more common in the past than they are now, partly because of all these satirical images which were like spread around, but also because people just knew what portrait photographers were doing. And if you go into a portrait photographer and they offer to insert you into all of these different images, you know that lots of images are going to be manipulated.
So if we take that basic assumption that it's not necessarily the fakery itself that's increasing, but it's the awareness of it, is there a danger that we're increasingly becoming so sceptical that we end up being unnecessarily cynical about all of this?
Yeah, so I think there's a real problem. And this is a problem with the coverage and the discourse around fake images, that people will be encouraged to be blanket sceptical about all images that are printed everywhere, because they're getting this idea that like fake photographs are soon going to be everywhere. You won't be able to tell them apart from real photographs. It's impossible for you to tell the difference. And I think there's something quite worrying here, which is that those warnings that everyone's going to lose trust in all images might in fact make themselves true. One reasonable response to that is to not believe images when you're presented to them, even if actually the problem isn't as serious as that response would be warranted by, right? Like it's not, there are some faked photographs, they exist. But yeah, there is this real worry that people could become unnecessarily skeptical, and that the cause of that is actually all of these warnings about deepfakes rather than the existence of the images themselves.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
You've talked a bit about the need for greater institutions around this. When you look at the sort of institutional response of governments, of electoral commissions around the world and their equivalents, or of, you know, organizations like Twitter and Facebook, they often talk about technology needing to play catch up, as it were. Do you think the technological barrier is the main one here?
No, and I think what we're seeing here is an example of what Meredith Broussard calls techno-chauvinism, which is the transformation of what are really social problems into technological problems, for which it's then possible to propose technological solutions that a tech company can provide you, whether that in this case be making a watermarking system to show that a deepfake image has been produced by a particular technology, or automated detection systems. And I think one thing we get out of the historical record thinking about fake images is that there are really effective solutions to fake images, but they're social solutions. They're having journalistic institutions which are able to tell apart fake images from real images and have like effective social norms for basically policing within journalism people who spread images which aren't accurate. Yeah, there's something that's kind of like obvious about that. So it's like, why are you even saying that? But we're in a weird situation where people are really, really hyper aware of this problem. And the solution might be like, we just need better journalism, better like publicly funded, both local and national journalism, more people trying to solve the problem. And the solution that we're getting presented with again and again is this techno-chauvinist solution, which is invest more in the technology, even though you should also be really worried about the technology because technology is also like the problem that's going on here. I think that we need to like take a step back, reframe how things are thought about, both take a step back from these really like dire, scary warnings, but also think, yeah, more seriously about like what solutions might be helpful. And here the historical record is like a really helpful thing to, yeah, have in mind.
Well, thank you very much, Josh. You can read more of Josh's work in both academic journals like Synthes and also some really nifty summaries on YouTube. And thank you for joining us, dear listeners. We'll be back only too soon with another edition for your delectation. And if you enjoy the podcast, remember you can support us on Patreon from just £3 a month. You'll be supporting our ever-expanding catalogue of shows, including The Bunker, Oh God What Now, Paper Cuts, and Jam Tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
The Bunker was written and presented by Seth Tebow and was produced by Liam Tate. Audio production was from Robin Leeburn, art by Jim Parrott, and music by Kenny Dickinson. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.